science and technology in our lives. Then throw in some culture, history, ethics, philosophy, and religion. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. The universe is filled with planets. Just recently, scientists discovered something very special. Seven Earth-like planets, all circling the same star, with three of them likely to have liquid water on the surface. It brings to mind a question many astronomers ponder. What makes a planet habitable? Today we are joined by Dr. Ramses Ramirez. Ramses is a planetary scientist at the Carl Sagan Institute at Cornell. Ramses is interested in planets, both inside and outside our solar system, and researches what variables can make a world go from being barren and sterile to one that could potentially host life. So welcome to the podcast, Ramses.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Elizabeth.
Let's talk a little bit about what kind of planets are being found around other stars. So I know that there are lots of planets being discovered. Do you know what the current number of planets around other stars is?
Well, the current number of planets around other stars, it's an uncountable number of planets around other stars. I think we know that pretty well. There are many more planets and stars in the universe. But as far as what has been found so far, certainly we're on the order right now. This is March 2017. As of March 2017, there's some 3,400 confirmed exoplanets with at least 4,200 or so candidates waiting to be confirmed. So we have a large slew of exoplanets of all different sizes and radii and mass ranges. So, and the interesting thing about this sample of planets that we've been finding, earlier years before Kepler launched, one of the main techniques used to find planets around other stars has been radial velocity. And now we're using, Kepler's using this transit technique where basically a planet goes around a star. And basically, you can detect as the planet passes in front of a star how much the light of the star then dims. Because as the planet comes in front of the star, you can detect the dimming of that star, which is related to then its size. Now, what's interesting is that radial velocity, which is really has to do with the gravitational tug between the planet and the star, been kind of not superseded, but now the transit method has become even more popular than it. Because of the success of Kepler finding so many thousands of planets. And the general distribution of these planets is pretty much towards the smaller end, actually. We're finding lots of small planets that are Earth size, smaller than Earth size, a little bit bigger than Earth size, say between half a Earth radii to about four Earth radii. And this seems to be the bulk of the sample of planets that have been found. And they tend to be pretty close into the star, though, because the transit method, it's very sensitive to planets that are very close to their stars. It really works by detecting the dim that's caused in the star as the planet crosses in front of the star. But if a planet is too far away from the star, that dimming of the passage of the planet around the star becomes harder to detect.
Yeah, I remember a few years back when they were relying on their radial velocity method, which, for people who don't know, measures the gravitational pull of a planet on the star. They were finding lots of close-in planets that were really big, like think Jupiter or bigger, or around the size of Jupiter. And now with this transit method you mentioned, you're saying that they're finding a lot more smaller planets like Earth or Neptune or something like this.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that, as you mentioned, is that they're finding these smaller planets around smaller stars. Mm-hmm. Because it's around these smaller stars that the planets have a bigger impact on the stellar brightness. Because if it's a really big star, then it's really hard to detect a small planet around it and detect that dimming. But around a small star, an M star, these red dwarfs, they call them, these are these stars that are considerably cooler and smaller than the sun. You can certainly detect smaller planets with the transit method.
Right. I mentioned the planets that were recently found around this star called TRAPPIST-1.
Yes.
They found seven planets orbiting one star, and potentially three of them are in the habitable zone. So could you explain to people what astronomers mean when they say the habitable zone?
Great question, Elizabeth. The habitable zone is really, you can think of it as a circular region around a star in which liquid water could be stable on the surface of a rocky planet. So it's a kind of a Goldilocks zone. If the planet's too close to the star, it gets too hot, And on an Earth-like planet with oceans, the oceans evaporate to space and the planet just becomes a desert. Mm-hmm. And if it gets too far away, then the planet basically gets cold and freezes out. It can get more technical than this. That's the basic idea. So there's this sweet spot, this Goldilocks zone, this habitable zone around a star in which we think that temperatures can remain temperate.
Okay. Why is water so important when we're looking for life on a planet? Why do astronomers look for a place that liquid water can exist?
Liquid water is universal solvent. It's certainly what has worked here for life on the Earth. All life here on the Earth uses water in some shape or form. DNA, RNA, proteins, carbon-based life that we have all here on the Earth are all predisposed to having water as the thing that really unites us all as far as life is concerned. So at least it's the way life turned out here on the Earth. Now, that's not to say that that is the only way by which life, the only solvent that's used in the universe. There could be, for instance, life in the methane oceans of Titan. Mm-hmm. We don't know that. We'd have to actually go there to see for sure. But at least for what we know, for life as we know it here on the Earth, it seems to require all of it that we know of requires water. And so it stands to reason when we want to try to find life, we're a good starting point to find life that's kind of like our own life. Certainly, it's easier to try to find life that we recognize.
Right. If you were to figure out where the habitable zone in our own solar system is, where exactly would it be?
It's a great question. It really depends on the definition. There's several definitions that are being used depending on the assumptions and mm-hmm. based on observations or model calculations. But Venus is not inside the habitable zone, but somewhere between the orbit of Venus and Earth and just beyond the orbit of Mars. At least that's the traditional CO2 water habitable zone. CO2 and water are the main gases because those are the main greenhouse gases for the Earth. So if you want to give exact numbers to it, mm-hmm. we're located at about 1 AU, 1 astronomical unit from the sun. That's Earth's distance. The habitable zone conservatively could be between 0.95 AU and about 1.7 AU or so. Mm-hmm. So Earth's in it, kind of closer to the inner edge, but it's well within the habitable zone. And so that's a good thing to know. We're not losing our oceans to space.
We'll get back to talking to Ramses in a moment. But first, do you know that only 1 out of 5 people listen to podcasts? That's why this March is Tripod Month. Think of a friend, a family member, or a coworker who would love to listen to podcasts. And think of a great podcast for them. Then show them how to listen, on social media or in real life. Or tell people about the podcasts you'd love to listen to, share them on social media, or rate them. And share what you do with hashtag Tripod. That's TRYPOD. Thanks for spreading the word. Now, back to our podcast. So when scientists are calculating where the habitable zone is, a lot of them look at the properties of the star, mostly its temperature. So if a star is really hot, then the habitable zone will be farther out, so you can have liquid water on the surface of any planets. But if the star is a little cooler, then the habitable zone will be a little bit closer in. But you looked at some interesting things about the properties of the planets themselves and how the properties of the planets could change where the habitable zone is. So what kind of things did you look at?
So it's a great question. It really depends on the solar system you're in. What I specifically looked at is kind of agnostic about these Earth-based assumptions. Mm-hmm. The traditional habitable zone assumes that CO2 and water are the main greenhouse gases. But, you know, even then, the traditional habitable zone is also dependent on the planetary properties. For instance, the CO2 is able to build up on planets near the outer edge. You can have these outer edge planets that have several bars of CO2, even though they're farther away from their stars and they're not receiving a lot of energy from their sun, that extra CO2 that's keeping those planets warm in spite of their being farther away is because of plate tectonics and the carbonate silicate cycle that would operate on potentially habitable planets like it does here on the Earth.
Okay.
This is a cycle by which CO2 gets erupted out of volcanoes, it rains out of the atmosphere, the rocks reincorporate it, so you have like plate subduction carrying volatiles into the mantle, and then that again gets reincorporated into volcanoes and comes back out. So it's a cycle here that keeps Earth habitable for very long billions of year time scale. So the idea I added to this is, again, volcanism is still important, but then looked at the effects of hydrogen. Certainly there are many gases that come out of volcanoes, CO2 being just one of them, and water vapor and other gases, sulfur-based gases as well. But hydrogen also has shown in my earlier work that hydrogen could have been a very good greenhouse gas, not by itself, but certainly in an atmosphere that's composed of a background gas like CO2 or nitrogen. That CO2 and nitrogen can squeeze or collide with that hydrogen and cause the hydrogen to absorb really well and pick up the slack spectral regions or wavelength regions where CO2 and water do not absorb well. So after looking at the idea for early Mars, I thought, hey, you know, this might be a good idea to extend this exoplanets because it seemed to work really well for my early Mars simulations. And lo and behold, it really works really well. In my, you know, when I add that idea in there, basically what I find is that the habitable zone moves from, you know, the 1.7 or so that I mentioned for the CO2 water assumption to about 2.4 AU for our solar system. And then there's similarly wide extensions for the habitable zone around other stars. So it's a pretty big deal.
Okay, so basically you're talking about planets that have both volcanoes and plate tectonics that are helping to cycle the atmosphere a little bit quicker. Is this what you mean?
Yeah, so it cycles through the atmosphere. You're basically, it works really well on planets that outgassing lots of hydrogen because their mantle is oxygen poor, like we think is the case for early Mars. Early Mars, for instance, the meteorites tell us that its mantle was possibly hydrogen rich or oxygen poor. If that's the case, then hydrogen would have been a common volcanic product in that atmosphere. There's, you know, no reason to suspect that other planets couldn't operate that way. Hydrogen likes to escape. That's the bad thing about hydrogen. Hydrogen has this property that it's a very light gas. It likes to just poof, go out to space very quickly. But if you're able to slow down the escape somehow, because you have a larger planet with more gravity or a stronger magnetic fields, or there's some other properties about the atmosphere of that planet that makes it so hydrogen escapes slowly, or, you know, it's near the outer edge, so radiation from the star does not affect the hydrogen escape as badly, then all these factors can help build up hydrogen on these atmospheres and really give you a lot of bang for the buck.
Right, right. So these things like volcanoes and plate tectonics and earthquakes are all releasing hydrogen that counteracts the hydrogen that is escaping out into space.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. The thing is, yeah, hydrogen escapes very quickly, but if you're able to erupt enough of it to keep up with the escape, then you can maintain that atmosphere for a long time.
If you don't have any volcanoes, you don't have any tectonics, how would the atmosphere be then? So you would lose the hydrogen, but would you still have other greenhouse gases that could warm the planet as well? Or would those eventually also leave the atmosphere as well?
That's the thing. Unless you're really close to the star, you're getting a lot of energy from the star, like Venus. Venus is very hot. The temperatures are hot enough on the surface of Venus to melt lead. It's because you're so close to the sun. But a planet within the habitable zone that's far enough away from the star, if they're not replenishing their atmosphere somehow through a carbonate-silicate cycle, then it'll eventually die off. It'll eventually cool off. That's kind of what happened to Mars.
Okay.
And it's actually the main, you know, one of the main hypotheses for why the Earth has maintained its habitability over billions of years. It's because we think this carbonate-silicate cycle helps keep planets habitable. And it also explains why, for instance, we think that Earth has undergone periodic snowball events throughout its history. It's glaciated near completely or completely, but every time it's been able to get out of that situation, and life hasn't been able to survive because, in large part, because of this carbon silicate cycle. So eventually, you have volcanoes that will eventually break through the ice and out of that, get you out of the snowball. They'll raise temperatures high enough on the planet, Earth in this case, to get you out of that snowball. And so, yeah, you really need plate tectonics operating. If it didn't have plate tectonics, probably the planet would die.
That's interesting. So these things that we associate to be bad, volcanoes and earthquakes, we actually owe our existence to them.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I don't consider volcanoes bad. They're actually good. But, yeah, they're great. They provide lots of gases that the atmosphere needs.
Right.
And yeah, they're important. In moderation, of course. You can have too much of a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. So speaking of a lot of volcanism, I know the moon of Io, one of the moons of Jupiter, has a ton of volcanism. So does this moon have so much volcanism that it has a very hot atmosphere as well, that the habitable zone could be kicked all the way out there?
Well, see, yeah, that's a good question. Io is actually a strange, different case. You don't have plate tectonics in the way that they operate on the Earth. But what you do have is a system of some sort. You have tidal heating from kind of this tug of war between the other Jupiter moons and Jupiter and Io. They're all kind of flexing Io's crust back and forth and causing all this volcanism to spew out of Io. And what that does is that does give you sort of like a transient atmosphere, but doesn't give you the sustained thick atmosphere and warm, very hot temperatures that you would get on Earth, for instance. It's just because you're so far away. It's actually a good case in point with the habitable zone. You're too far away from the Goldilocks zone to maintain warm surface conditions. Mm-hmm. And the same holds true for, say, Titan, which is Saturn's biggest moon. It has a thick atmosphere, even thicker pressure-wise than the Earth. But it's still very cold because it's just way outside of the habitable zone.
Okay, so what about the moon, I think it's Europa, that potentially could have a ocean underneath the crust? This is outside the habitable zone, but is it because it's inside the planet that this is potentially liquid?
Yes, and that's a very good point. I think it's precisely why. Europa is definitely very cold on the surface. It's not thought to be a habitable planet, at least by our standards, it's not. But the thing with Europa, and even Enceladus to a big extent, is that there's a big icy crust that's on the order of maybe kilometers on Europa, or maybe even a kilometer or less in some spots, but a pretty good ice layer that covers this underwater ocean. And yeah, the ocean's able to maintain its liquid properties partly because of that. Probably because there's also some underwater volcanic activity that's helping keep things warm under there. So there's other factors involved, but certainly it's a different scenario than being exposed on the surface.
Right, right. So let's go back to these TRAPPIST-1 planets. So if one of these planets hypothetically were to be volcanic or to be very tectonically active, how many planets might have liquid water now rather than three? Could there be potentially more planets that might have liquid water?
Yeah, you actually raised the cool implication of our results on this wider hydrogen habitable zone. So yeah, actually on the star system around TRAPPIST-1, the outer edge of this hydrogen habitable zone that we proposed just about gets that fourth TRAPPIST-1 planet, making it a fourth TRAPPIST-1 planet in the habitable zone. Okay. So TRAPPIST-1H, within the error bars, could potentially be within the outer edge, which would make it very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about actually observing these planets. So is there any way to observe these planets and figure out if they actually are volcanic or are tectonically active?
Oh, that's a very good question. That's very hard to do. If we're able to characterize the atmospheric spectra of planets or their atmospheric signatures, which we can through some techniques, we can separate the planet spectrum from the star spectrum and get each gas leaves fingerprint in the planetary spectrum that you can detect. Mm-hmm. So you can tell, by looking at where in a planetary spectrum a gas is absorbed, you can tell what type of gas it is. If it's CO2, water, or methane, or hydrogen. So potentially, if you can tease out this spectral fingerprint for a planet, you can infer whether volcanism could be happening on that planet.
Okay.
That's one way to do it.
Okay. So what about looking at these planets and finding if they host life from a distance? I know that there are biosignatures you could see in the atmosphere as well.
Yeah, so certainly the question of life is probably the most important question. At least that's the reason why I'm in this field and why this is something I've been interested in since I was probably 4 or 5 years old, is trying to find if we are alone in the universe. There's ideas for how you might be able to detect signs of alien life or extraterrestrial life by looking at atmospheric signatures. Although there's lots of false positives, there's lots of different ways that you can produce a lot of these gases without biology. So they're not, none of them have been shown to be foolproof. But one common combination is methane and oxygen.
Okay.
These are both gases that are, can be produced biologically, and they're also very different energetically. Methane's, you know, very hydrogen-rich, oxygen-poor, and oxygen, of course, oxygen is the prototype of oxygen-rich gas. They're like opposites in that sense. If you see those two in an atmosphere, and that could be life. Some people have said that if you see that type of signature, that could be suggestive of life. Although there's some arguments suggesting also that life can also drive things towards equilibrium. So it's not a 100% sure way of finding life.
Yeah. So are there any telescopes that are coming up that you're excited about potentially getting some exciting results from?
Certainly. I mean, there's a... TESS is actually the big one that'll be interesting that might provide some nice little target list for JWST to look at. James Webb Space Telescope is another interesting mission coming up. But probably the mission that I'm most interested in is TPF, which is the Terrestrial Planet Finder.
Mm.
You know, this is a proposed concept that might come, who knows, in the 2030s or 2040s. And that's supposed to be able to detect an Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone. So that's really the prize right there. And looking forward to that. Looking forward to this gradual progression of improved missions. And even our next generation telescopes here on the ground are going to be really cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to have these extremely large telescopes, GMT, all these like super large telescopes will be able to also have improved capabilities for resolving planets here on the ground. They'll be able to resolve planets pretty close to their stars, we hope.
Well, I certainly look forward to it as well. Well, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you, Elizabeth, for having me, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed this.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcast. Remember to share your favorite podcasts during March, Tripod Month. And please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. You can also find us on facebook.com/sparkdialogue, on Twitter @sparkdialogue, or on the web @sparkdialogue.com. And as always, thanks for listening.